This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Today we're talking about public health in Indiana and a new report on how it might be improved. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a high-quality voice message with our smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. And we're joined now by two guests. Paul Halverson is the founding dean and professor at the Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. And Valerie Yeager is an associate professor at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Welcome. Thank you both for joining today.
Great. Glad to be here with you.
So yeah, excited.
Paul, if you could, you know, tell us first, just give us a broad general understanding. You know, what is public health?
Well, that, you know, that's really a great question. And I think that's one of the findings, frankly, Jill, of our report, was that there is a general lack of understanding of what public health is and what it does for us. And that in part has been part of the problem in Indiana, I'm convinced. And we can talk more about what that means. But public health is actually, the Institute of Medicine did a great job in defining it. It says it's what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. It essentially establishes the community where we live as an environment that is healthy, that allows people to actually make healthy choices. You know, we do have this view, particularly I think as Hoosiers, that people ought to just be able to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, make good, healthy choices, and that's all you need to do. The reality is that the environment in which we live in our communities is actually a big part of what makes us healthy or unhealthy. And so having that focus on the infrastructure, the systems, the services actually within the community and throughout our state that really are designed to protect and improve our health is crucial for us to keep healthy. And I think that's a big part of it as well. When we think about public health, we ought to be thinking about prevention and quality of life. And I think, you know, again, one of the main issues that we face here in Indiana is that we rank 41st out of 50 states in terms of our overall health. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, it's been that way for a long while. There was one time, actually, about 25 years ago, that we were number 26. We were almost average, but we've been below average and frankly in the 40s for a long time. When I first came here to Indiana, which I love being a Hoosier, enjoy being here in Indiana, but you know, the reality is that we were going to buy a button that said, you know, we're done with 41, because we had been ranked 41st for like three or four years in a row. And, you know, I guess the good news and bad news is we didn't have to buy any more buttons because we kept sticking at 41, which is our current ranking. And in terms of our public health system, we rank 48th out of 50 states in terms of what we invest on a per capita basis to public health. So we need public health. And, you know, I think that's the other piece of this is if you talk to most people across the country, frankly, around what they think public health is, they immediately think about taking care of medical services for poor people, maybe immunizations for babies, or perhaps doing restaurant inspections or septic tank permits. And, you know, depending upon where you live, all of those services could be provided by public health, but it's so much more than that. And the fact of the matter is we really do not have, with very few exceptions, a strong, robust public health system in our state. And so if for us, what is normal is not necessarily normal in other parts of the country in terms of the lack of public health capacity.
I know lots of states are obviously doing better than us, you know, 48th in public health spending, 41 in health outcomes. You know, we've, like you said, we've been on the bottom tier here for quite a while. And I know a lot of people are aware of that and have been working on that. And you talked about a lot that we need to unpack here today. You know, but you sort of touched on this, the difference between public health and health care. I mean, you know, these are two totally separate things that a lot of times do get lumped together.
Well, they do. And they're related, though, right? I mean, frankly, our medical care system, our health care system is designed to principally heal us, to restore health once we already have a disease. There are things that, and I'm thankful for the fact that many of our medical care systems and healthcare systems are working towards trying to include a greater emphasis on prevention. But we spend about 97% of the funding in our health system, which is an enormous amount of money, on taking care of people that already have disease. Public health is about preventing disease. And I think that's the biggest difference, is that at the end of the day, we're trying to prevent disease from occurring in the first place and to preserve a quality of life. You know, just because we live in Indiana, the characteristics of our state, and we live less of a life than you would in the average U.S. state. In other words, our life expectancy is lower than the U.S. average. Mm-hmm. And our medical care spending is more. And in part, it's because we're sicker. So when we do get sick, when we do go to the doctor or the hospital, we are generally further along in terms of the disease process. And that takes away from the quality of our life as well as the quantity of life. Mm-hmm. And so these are all factors that frankly are interrelated. And so if we can increase and improve our public health in Indiana, we could reduce our medical care spending and we could improve our quality and quality of life.
Yeah, because it takes a whole lot more money to make someone well in Indiana and every other state. Valerie, yeah. I'd like to turn to you. You know, can you tell us, this is a specific report that we're, you know, looking at today. Can you tell us about this report that you worked on? It's about public health, obviously. You know, what was your goal? What did you want to find out?
Thanks. Yeah, initially we were looking to see what the public health system in Indiana looks like at the moment. Obviously, COVID has raised some alarms about some inefficiencies and some infrastructure needs for our public health system. And so we set out to talk to individuals and stakeholders around the state about their experiences with public health, either as a public health practitioner themselves or as individuals who interact with public health, and to assess what are some of our structural needs, how are we doing so far in terms of indicators. And so our report includes interviews with 49 key stakeholders around the state, including some members of our legislature, leading organization CEOs, and those who are leading and interacting with public health. We also reviewed the scientific evidence around public health systems, which is the area that my work and Paul Haverson's work focus on, is public health from a systems perspective. And so we look at that evidence and we summarize what we know works in this report and use that to make recommendations for ways that Indiana can consider making improvements to the public health system.
So this report entitled Indiana Public Health System Review, you know, obviously, like you said, takes a look at different places across the state and public health infrastructure. You know, that's a big key part of it. Can you talk about what that means?
Sure. So our infrastructure includes everything from the workers who conduct and make the work happen to the surveillance systems that we report infectious diseases to the state. It includes how we track funding and where we spend money. And historically, this infrastructure system has been chronically underfunded. And Indiana is not alone in this. This is a national challenge. If you've seen any of the investments to our healthcare system in trying to move them from paper-based systems to electronic systems. Mm-hmm. In 2009, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act invested $27 billion in helping physicians and hospitals in making this change. This past year, public health was given $50 million to do this. And so you can see the disparity that the public health system has. And in some recent work that I've conducted with some colleagues, we look to see how well connected public health agencies and hospitals are. And we in particular looked at the hospital perspective, and a lot of the reasons that were given in a national survey of hospitals is that the systems can't talk to each other and public health doesn't have the resources to make those changes. So when you think about COVID and reporting from a hospital to public health, what's going on in their systems, there's disconnects. And we end up manually providing this information through paper. And that's 1980.
Right. This report as well is meant to have, you know, actionable framework. And we're hoping to get into that. But I mean, you saw that, you know, county level, too, it's really across the board on whether or not health systems are functioning well.
For sure. If you look at our county system, what you see in Indiana are extremely small local public health agencies. So we have 94 local public health agencies, and they range in size from 3 to 4 people to 180 people, Marion County, I think, is at around 800 staff members. So we've got quite a diversity in size. And we also have a problem in that in those small local health departments, they have enough staff to be doing things like vital records and environmental health inspections and the necessary vaccination clinics. Mm. They have an administrator who runs things and usually a local health official who is part-time and really has a responsibility for signing essential orders. But what that means is that public health doesn't have the time in those settings to be doing community education or outreach clinics or working on their preparedness plans and how they're going to stand up an emergency response. Mm-hmm. They don't have that capacity to be networking with the hospitals and the primary care physicians who are part of the public health system and help extend the resources that public health has to do a better job.
Well, it is a lot, and we have a lot to talk about, talking about public health today on All In. If you have comments or questions, find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. We're talking today about public health in Indiana. A new report from researchers at IUPUI looks into the reasons public health is underfunded in Indiana and the tangible impact it would have to increase that funding. We'd love to have your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send it your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. And we're joined again now by two guests. Paul Halverson is the founding dean and professor at Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. And Valerie Yeager is an associate professor at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. So, Paul, let me ask you, you know, we were talking about it. A lot of people's understanding of the concept of public health is different from the reality. Why is it important for people to have a more detailed understanding of this concept, would you say?
Well, I think it's really important because they need to understand how public health impacts them. Right. I mean, the reality, and I think this is true also for our legislators, because I think that our legislators really want to make a difference and they want to take care of their constituents and do the best thing for our state. The problem is that we perhaps in public health have not done the best job in helping people understand what they're missing. And so, again, going back to the question you were talking with Dr. Yeager about, with what is public health, and in particular, how does that work in the local community? What we have in Indiana is 94 completely independent collection of public health departments that do little of the same thing and not in a coordinated way. We also have a state health department that is substantially under-resourced. I would add all of our health department folks, whether it's at the state level or the local level, they're hardworking, very passionate about what they're doing, but they're not equipped. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of people working in public health have no formal training in public health. They don't have the equipment or the technology that they need. It's like sending an army out to fight a battle, but you don't give them any bullets for the gun, or you don't give them the body armor to protect them. And that's the sort of normal condition that we face right now in public health in Indiana. We need to adopt a uniform set of services that, regardless of where you live, public health provides these things. And we've recommended in our report, for example, that we adopt the foundational public health services that has been sort of a consensus nationally of what should be provided in public health. And it includes all of those things in the infrastructure piece that Valerie mentioned, but it includes, for example, functions in communicable disease control, chronic disease and injury prevention, environmental public health, maternal child and family health, and access to and linkage with clinical care as just sort of the standard. Regardless of where you live, you ought to have that. The problem here in Indiana is that we have one or two things that we do. In fact, there's a requirement by state law of all the things that are mandatory. And that mandatory list is just a core skeleton of what should be done. And even for that, we don't finance it appropriately. What we find in Indiana is about 70% of the budget for a local health department comes from local taxpayers. And that's not at all the norm for the rest of the country. If you look at local health departments in the rest of the country, what you find is that local funding, it may be about the same amount that we're spending now, but in if you look at budgets in other states, what you'd see is about 30% of the funding coming from the local community and about 70% coming from the state. And some of that, of course, is federal pass-through money. There was a time most recently where we were last in the country as it relates to funding from our Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And again, that's really not something to be proud of, because the CDC has funding to support state public health, and states in turn could support local public health. But we're not organized in a way to coordinate our care, nor are we organized in a way to make sure that every community, every citizen in the state gets the benefit of public health. And that's been our major dilemma, is that it shouldn't matter where you live. There ought to be certain services, regardless, that you ought to be able to get. Our report calls for resource sharing. In other words, we have 94 health departments. Not every little health department can afford to have a full-time epidemiologist and risk communicator and preparedness director and so forth and so on. But we need to figure out a way in which we can hire some of these people that are available for the region, and then be able to find a way to share those resources amongst the people and amongst the departments, so that it could be equitably shared and that the services could be available. But again, part of the issue is that we need to help people understand what they're missing, which again would be related to ways in which to create the conditions under which we are healthier. So just as an example, we rank 44th out of 50 states in terms of our tobacco use. Mm-hmm. It is the leading cause of preventable death in Indiana. Costs us on the average of about $7 billion a year, both in medical care costs and lost productivity. And it takes around 11,000 people a year who die of tobacco-related disease. If we were doing what we should be doing, we would be focusing very, very strongly, using an evidence-based approach to both to to figure out a way. And we know the way. We know how to fix the tobacco problem in Indiana, but it takes a strong public health system, and it also takes the legislature to work with us to use evidence-based strategies to support public health. And unfortunately, we haven't had the people at either the state health department or the local health department with the tools and the resources necessary to actually even bring some of these issues to the forefront.
Yeah, and I know that this is an issue you've been working on for many years, you know, with cigarette tags at the state house. And we've been, you know, considering that issue and many things that could go into improving public health. Valerie, can I ask you, you know, when we look at this report, you know, how much money does go towards public health in Indiana? And again, you know, people have been talking to lawmakers for a long time and trying to change policy. Has funding for public health changed in recent years in Indiana?
So a small portion of the state's general fund goes to what public health does in Indiana. And this is what our report is recommending be considered as a potential change. You asked me the question about infrastructure, and one thing that I think is hard for people to understand is that public health dollars are typically what we call categorical. So when they receive a grant that's supposed to be focused on, preventing infant mortality, they can't use those dollars to upgrade any of their software or to upgrade the computers that they've had since 1992. And so the infrastructure restrictions on the funding that typically is received in public health limit public health's ability to build some of that they need. And so if we were to get the state to provide, and by way of our legislature and our governor setting a budget that would increase the amount of infrastructure dollars that are available to public health, they could come up to speed on technology and IT, the IT highway that we need for the public health system. To the exact dollar amount, to be honest, I don't have that, but I would have to look at my report to be able to give that to you correctly.
I think it's $41 per capita national average, and we're way below that.
Oh, right. In a per capita spending, for sure. Yeah, we're way below that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some of our local agencies, their funding is substantially lower than the national average. In some of our local public health agencies, it's less than $10 per capita.
Hmm. Paul, you know, we were talking about, you know, heading towards a little bit of the political background around these. What are some of the immediate and tangible reasons that more funding doesn't end up going towards public health in Indiana? Is it all just politics?
No, I don't think so. I really do think that giving the legislators the benefit of the doubt, I don't know that they understand what they're missing. Mm-hmm. And we have never really had a robust public health system in our state. And so, you know, we have such a low level of public health services in our state that we think that's normal. And that's why our report was so important, because we wanted to point out, and we looked at our surrounding states, and we looked at some of the best case states, and we looked at states that were similar to ours in both politically and structurally and so forth and so on, rural and urban and all those things. And what we found was that we're really an outlier. And in most cases, if you look at our surrounding states and then us in Indiana, we are really either in last place or next to last place when it comes to certain diseases, when it comes to funding and supporting public health. So we need to help our legislators understand why making an investment in public health is worth it. So one of the things that we've done in our report, and actually this is some research that a colleague, Dr. Glenn Mays from now at the University of Colorado, we used to work together. And about 20 years ago, we started doing a longitudinal review of public health performance in health departments across the country. We had an opportunity about 3 years ago to actually do a statewide survey of public health performance in Indiana. And we had a good response rate. And we were able to essentially determine that Indiana's overall performance in these nationally developed services, we're really lagging behind. And so part of what we need to think through is, and we also need to correlate this with, is this is where we actually determined that if we were to make X investment, we actually could get a return. So, for example, because of our investment is being so low, our length of our life expectancy is actually lower than the U.S. average, and our medical care expenses are higher. We actually make estimates in our report of how, by making a greater investment in public health, we can actually turn that investment into a payback. In other words, we know that if we could get just even to the U.S. average, we could improve the life expectancy of people in Indiana by like about a year and a half. And we could reduce our medical expenditures substantially. And frankly, if we could get to the level where we were in the fully functional public health system level, we could improve our life expectancy by like 4 years. And we could improve our reduce our medical care costs substantially more than what we actually invest in public health. So what we've demonstrated in our research is that this is really should be thought about as an investment. It's not just simply that we're paying more money to hire more public health people. What we're doing is creating the conditions under which we can live longer and healthier, higher quality of life. So that's the message I think that we want to try to help our legislators understand. It's just, it's an infrastructure and it's sort of like a bridge or a power plant. I mean, everyone wants to use it. No one wants to pay for it, right? So we want to be able to have the infrastructure and the ability to have a long, a fruitful life and live a high quality life. And unfortunately, in Indiana, we're robbed of that, not because we want to, but because we don't recognize the importance. It's like basically building all the fire stations 20 miles out of town and then wondering why, when there's a fire, we can't get there quickly enough.
And like you said, I mean, we know what to do. You know, we know the steps that would take, you know, to improve health on the front end, to be preventative, and the things that public health, you know, can do to make that happen. And we actually have a call from a listener who has a question, you know, about some of those things that you know, we can really do. And who has a question specifically about smoking bans and zoning laws. So let's take
sure.
a listen.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Ruth. I'm calling about smoking bans in multifamily housing, which we don't have one out here. So I'd like your guests to discuss that and how, you know, the enormous impact it would make for no cost, and also improving building codes here to make the indoor air quality better and the buildings more sustainable. Thank you.
So from Ruth there, thank you, Ruth. If you'd like to weigh in on that, Paul.
Sure. So we know that in particular, there's been some regulations at the federal level around multi-unit housing, particularly those that are federally supported. And we know that smoking bans in multi-unit housing work. Here's the issue. What works most successfully, the most evidence-based strategy to reduce tobacco use in this state and others, is increasing the cost of the product. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a problem in Indiana because we hate taxes worse than we hate just about anything. But believe it or not, the tax, increasing the tax on tobacco, is actually the most evidence-based intervention. And it actually brings us money, which we believe should be allocated to public health to, again, support the need for filling the deficits that we have. But regardless of what you use the money for, increasing the cost of the tobacco product will greatly reduce consumption. And particularly, we'll see the greatest impact of the tobacco increase on younger people. The younger you are, or the less money that you have in terms of a per capita income, the greater the impact will accrue in terms of reducing tobacco use. Now, there's an ethical piece that we need to consider as well, which is if we increase the cost of the product, we absolutely must help people find ways in which to quit tobacco. Because the worst thing would be is to raise the price of the tobacco and have people continue to smoke. We know that they will quit, but the issue is how can we help them quit in a scientific and medically approved way so that actually they quit for good? And so, again, the indoor air bans are important. I mean, that's an example, though, here in Indiana. We have some indoor air bans, but they are so weak that many convention and visitor bureau rating systems don't even give us credit for having indoor tobacco laws because we have so many loopholes in our system. So we could do better. We need to do better. But we also need to take that broad approach. So just as an example, though, Jill, going back to this issue around having infrastructure, at the state and the local level, we need to have people who are dedicated not just in promoting tobacco taxes, but helping to lead youth and school-age programs that focus on understanding why tobacco use is bad, why vaping is a problem, and how to actually curtail use, how to do education programs. So that's an example. If we had effective resources in our community and at the state level, we could do a much better job of promoting healthy living through reducing smoking and vaping. And, you know, this is just an example, but and add about, you know, 15 other things that would ultimately be improved if we actually took our public health seriously. One last thing to add, which is related to the fact that it's not good enough to just say, oh, well, let's give the public health departments more money. That's not what we're advocating. We're advocating for a responsible, uniform approach to the services that would be provided. We also advocate for national accreditation of all of our public health departments. Mm-hmm. In Indiana, we only have two. Only two of our 94 health departments are nationally accredited. We could do a whole lot better than that.
Well, we'll take a look at some of those local programs, and maybe this year for the cigarette tax is what I'm hearing. Back after a quick break, talking with researchers about public health in Indiana. You can reach us at Facebook or Twitter, All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. We're talking today about public health in Indiana with two researchers who recently looked into the issue. As always, we would love to hear your questions or comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from, 866-476-3881. We're joined live today by two guests. Paul Halverson is the founding Dean and Professor at the Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Also from the school, Valerie Yeager. So thank you again both for being here. Valerie, you know, I know that for this report, you talked to a lot of people from all around the state. You know, what were some really interesting things that you heard from people, and did anything surprise you?
Yeah, I think what we initially were surprised by was that there is, like we've talked about earlier, not a clear understanding between the differences in health and public health. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we heard that members of our legislature are not sold on the idea that changing behavior changes health. And so that's why we spent so much of the 96 pages of the report in explaining public health systems, the impact of investing in public health. And we also try to make a strong case, because we realized from stakeholders that this is also not understood, that there's a bi-directional relationship between health and wealth. So the sicker you are, the harder it is for you to grow your wealth. And the wealthier you are, the greater the likelihood that you can invest in staying healthy. And this is for individuals, but it also applies to communities. So communities that are healthy earn more, their businesses grow. And so that bi-directional relationship in supporting health and wealth, if we as a state invest in keeping people healthy, can grow our state. And we learned from some of our larger businesses that they recognize that nobody wants to be taxed more. And we have very low tax rates for individuals and corporations in our state. And that's aligned with philosophical perspectives that are longstanding. But those industries pay higher taxes. They just do it in the costs of covering health care for their employees.
Yeah. We have a listener who is weighing in now, Rock, with a question about Indiana's environmental record. So let's listen to that.
This is Rock from Ferdinand, Indiana. Appreciate the topic today, and I'm wondering if the folks on the discussion today could talk about the relationship between Indiana's environmental record. We rank even worse environmentally year in and year out. Air quality, for example, recently was 49th in the state, and making some efforts toward improving that and therefore improving our public health, which obviously is related to the air we breathe, the water we drink. Thank you.
So, Paul, maybe I'll have you take that from Rock there. You know, we know that environmental health is a big part of it as well.
Absolutely. And if you look at the, you know, over the last, in the last century, we gained 25 years just due to public health initiatives, 30 years overall, five allocated to the medical care system, 25 due to public health initiatives. And many of those public health initiatives had to do with environmental health. So Rock is exactly correct. And in fact, one of the things that I find that most people are extremely surprised about when it comes to Indiana health is how poor our air quality is. In fact, we do rank at about anywhere from 47 to 49 out of 50 states in terms of our air quality, which is really surprising because in most parts of the state, you look out, you look out and you see the sky and you don't see the smog that you might see in Los Angeles or Chicago or some of the other areas. But what we do know is when you look at things like childhood asthma, COPD in adults, when you look at the overall air quality, we know that we have a problem. And again, whether it's our air or whether it's the water, again, we have substantial challenges. And, you know, environmental health is part of public health. And this is one of those examples where we need to pay attention to environmental health. One of the things, of course, we know that we've been following is lead in our drinking water. In some areas, particularly in communities that have older housing stock, we know that the lead exposure, particularly to our children that are in developmental ages, is adversely impacting them. We know that there's lead in the pipes and actually then in the schools, in the drinking fountains and so forth. So we have to be constantly vigilant and have a strong public health system to be able to, first of all, understand and detect the problem, and then to have intelligent, science-based interventions that actually can address the situation that we have. Again, you look at it, cause and effect. If you look at our coal-fired power plants, for example, I know that we enjoy coal. But on the other hand, from a health perspective, it's not a good thing. And so as a consequence, we need to be very concerned about the air we breathe and the water we drink. And all of that comes back to an essential part of what we call our public health system.
And you've mentioned it, you know, a couple of times, and I just really want to put it out there again that, you know, there is clear disparity in where someone lives and what their zip code is as to whether or not, you know, whether or not they have lead in their pipes, you know, whether or not they have access to healthy food. So there's a lot of work we have to do here in Indiana. We do have a listener voicemail from Aaron who has a question about what we were talking about, you know, some of the psychological reasons behind a culture, not just in Indiana, but, you know, across the country, I would say, that doesn't value preventative care. Let's listen to that now.
Hello, this is Aaron Nell. I'm calling from Indianapolis. And I think one of the reasons why, in general, there's not a lot of movement and support and resources for preventative health and health kind of in general is because a lot of our leaders are male. And there's this sense that you've got to be strong, you've got to be tough, and to ask for help and to ask for resources means that somehow you're weak and there's something wrong. And unfortunately, that carries into policy. So I hope as we move forward, we pass this and see that taking care of ourselves and doing preventative work is needful and something that'll make our community stronger.
Certainly not a uniquely American problem, but definitely a problem that we see here.
Well, I think Eric hit the nail right on the head. I think that was a great observation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, speak to that because that's, you know, a lot of why we can't get behind this. It's a cultural thing.
Well, it is a cultural thing. And so here's the other cultural piece. We have an incredible medical care system. Mm-hmm. What that has done to us, however, is we've come to believe we don't have to take care of ourselves. All we have to have is an insurance card. And when we get a disease, all we need to do is go to the doctor or the hospital and they'll fix it. The problem is that fix is not nearly as good as prevention in the first place. And it's incredibly expensive. And it's also false. There's only so much that medicine can do. And we have some of the smartest doctors, great researchers. I think Indiana is blessed with incredible resources in terms of our hospital and medical care system. But at the end of the day, none of it is as good as preventing the disease in the first place. Frankly, in advanced public health systems across the world, what we see is you can do a really, really great job in preventing disease, and you can increase people's length of life and improve their quality of life. People are still going to die of something, right? And so we would be better off allocating the medical care resources to things that are not necessarily as easily prevented, and focus on trying to take care of people in the lowest cost realm, which is, again, that the cost to prevent a disease is pennies on the dollars as compared to the amount of money we spend to take care of a problem that could have been prevented in the first place. But we've grown to believe that we don't have the responsibility to take care of ourselves, or we don't have the responsibility to take care of the community that then allows us to have these good choices. You know, one of the fallacies is that, you know, people ought to just pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and make good choices. You can't make good choices if there aren't good choices to choose from, right? So there are people who live in areas right here in Indianapolis where they live in a food desert. So their only source of good, fresh, nutritious food is 2 bus exchanges away from where they live. So their 7-Eleven or their, you know, convenience store may be the only place where they can go to get their groceries. And guess what? There's not nearly the level of variety or availability of fresh fruits and vegetables in some of these convenience stores. Now, again, there's some experiments and we're seeing expansions, but the reality is that we've got to try to create the conditions in the community where people can make healthy choices. And right now, we really lack that here in Indiana. And we need to focus on doing more to be able to help the vast majority of the people in our community be able to make healthy choices.
So just being in the middle of the largest public health crisis that we've seen in our lifetimes. Valerie, what impact would you say that the pandemic has had on some of the issues that we're talking about today?
Well, public health is at least on the radar. And prior to COVID-19, when public health is doing its normal job and things are going well, nobody knows about it, nobody talks about it, and we don't see it. So to the previous listener's comment about, you know, trying to get people to be more willing to participate in their own prevention of illness, we need to be able to know what public health is, to expect what it can provide for us, and to create more value towards it. So that's we're not just underfunded in the public health system, we're undervalued. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because people don't understand its role. When you think about the local level, which, as Dr. Halverson mentioned, is where about 70% of public health funding in our state is coming from, those local decision makers, we've heard from the stakeholders we've interviewed, don't understand the value of public health. So it's the last thing that they think about funding when they're making their local financial choices. And it's the first thing that they think about cutting. So now that they've seen the impact of an infectious disease outbreak on their communities, that may change their decision making in the future. But I think we as a public health system need to do a good job of communicating risk and communicating the potential of public health as an effective system.
Mm-hmm. And Paul, I've got to ask you as well, you know, the public health elephant in the room, you know, the pandemic has certainly worsened some issues that we've been talking about today and maybe highlighted other issues that were already there. You know, what do you think the impact has been?
Yeah, I think it's been devastating. I think that the reality is, again, we have great people doing the very best they can. But let's just take, for example, the surveillance and contact tracing. Contact tracing, being able to identify the people who are positive and then being able to have them identify people they've been in contact with, that is the way in which we box in this disease. Essentially, we find out who's been exposed, isolate them so that they're not spreading it to other people. We know that from our study here in Indiana that around 40% of the people that are positive are actually asymptomatic. They don't even know that they're transmitting this disease. So contact tracing is essential. But poor Dr. Box, I mean, she's a great health officer. She's done a terrific job as our state health commissioner. She didn't have much of a choice. Given the poor resources that we have in this state, when it came to making a choice about contact tracing, she elected to take funding that came from the CARES Act and invest it in a centralized telephone service. I mean, someone that would sit in a telephone bank and call people and try to elicit, who have you been around and so forth and so on. And it has been one of the ways that she's been able to centralize an important service. But if you look at contact tracing in mature, properly resourced public health jurisdictions, what they are able to do is to allocate funding to support local people working on trying to understand and work with their neighbors and community members to better understand where they've been, how to essentially isolate, and then to be able to follow up with information around testing and vaccine administration. So again, one of the challenges that we faced in Indiana, we've got great people, and there's no bad people here. This is just the fact that we didn't have the local health departments to be able to rise to the occasion. And Dr. Box made the choice that she had to make, which is we have to do it somehow. We maybe need to, job this out. And the same thing is true around vaccine. I mean, again, we don't have the infrastructure at the local level to actually administer this vaccine. We have to rely on a lot of partners. And again, that's probably preferred anyway in terms of vaccine. But again, if we had a more robust public health system, that coordination and advocacy and advertising and so forth and so on could have been much more effectively done. But now we look to the pharmacies and hospital systems and so forth. And again, getting the appropriate vaccine supply is going to be one of our big issues. But again, if we had more robust public health systems at the local level, we'd be able to then take that information and more effectively coordinate it and leverage the local know-how and the local community knowledge, and then marry that with the science so that we can actually be more efficient and effective in how we respond to this issue. So there's countless examples where, from a public health emergency perspective, lots of things have been, we've missed things that we shouldn't have missed. We should be much more attuned and understanding the risks and the issues in our communities, and then mounting effective campaigns to support the improvement of health, whether it's uncontrolled high blood pressure, which is, again, a major issue in our state, or it could be any number of things that, a strong local health department understands the issues of health in their community, and they can design programs that work, that are culturally appropriate and supportive of the people in the community. And that's really what we lack.
Yeah. And that, could help in all of the realms that we've been talking about today.
Yeah.
Diabetes, smoking, heart disease, all these things that are now influenced by COVID-19. And
that's right.
And, I've heard some people say that maybe a greater awareness now of this issue will be the sort of silver lining of everything.
Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be nice.
People that we've lost, people that have died here in Indiana, and people that we know that have been affected by COVID. Wouldn't it be nice if we could actually learn from this lesson that one of the ways in which we can respond is by investing in our public health system, holding them accountable? I'm not saying just give them money and hope for good things. We need to actually make smart investments in our public health system, holding people accountable, creating an expectation around meeting national standards for public health, and then essentially watching the incredible work that could go on with an effective public health system.
Well, that's going to have to be it. And I thank you both so much. Paul Halverson, founding dean and professor at the Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Also from the school, Valerie Yeager, associate professor. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer. If you'd like a podcast of this show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Thanks for listening. This is All In.